Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Matt Slater, and welcome to the Business of Sport podcast on The Athletic. Now, coming up today, we'll be reacting to the news that Gary Hoffman has announced he is resigning as chairman of the Premier League after just 18 months in the job. He will step down at the end of January 2022. The Athletic revealed on Tuesday that Hoffman was leaving, and it followed David Ornstein's story last month that some Premier League clubs wanted Hoffman to leave his position with the Premier League. We are joined by Simon Johnson, currently chair of the Rugby Football League. He spent 5 years as chief operating officer at the English Football Association and was director of legal and business affairs at the Premier League before that. Also with us is Alex Horne, former chief executive of the English FA for 5 years, who oversaw the financing, completion and opening of both Wembley Stadium and the National Football Centre. Okay, so thanks so much for joining us, guys. Let's start with a nice, gentle one. Simon, what actually is a chairman? And how do they work?
A chairman is somebody who is, in the simple terms, is there to chair a board or chair a company or a group of shareholders. But it goes much further than that. And I think the thing you have to remember is the distinction between a chair and a chief executive. So a chair is part-time, what we call non-executive. That means they're only working within the business for, it could be a couple of days a week, it could be a few days a month, but they're not there all the time. And their responsibility is to manage and oversee the executive team, to represent the views of the shareholders or stakeholders to the executive team, and to deal with issues and to make sure that the interests of the shareholders are always being looked after. I'm chair of two businesses. One is a sport, rugby league, and the other is a private business. And actually, there is a distinction between the two roles, because when you're the chair of a private company, it's all about the executive team. The chairman is the chair is a low key role. They're behind the scenes. They chair the meetings, they manage the staff, they represent the shareholders, and occasionally they'll be wheeled out to help to secure a deal or to maintain a relationship. They very rarely have a public role. It's very different in the case of a sport, because the chair there, as well as doing all of those things, is also expected to have a more public role. They might speak to the media, they might have their name on press releases, they might be expected to interact with and engage with fans. So there is a slight difference. And the Premier League as a company, for example, probably sits in between the two, because it is a private company, but it's also a sport. And it's got particular issues that we might get into. But that's essentially what a chair is and how it works within a sports organisation.
Simon, could you also just expand on a specific skill set that a good sporting chair would need? And then also how you find these people, how you recruit them?
The skill sets will largely differ, but there will be similar criteria applying to everybody. In a sport, you have to be able to deal with difficult, complex shareholders or stakeholder groups. There are lots and lots of stakeholders in a sport, from participants to administrators to members like clubs or counties or associations to fans and to the media. And being able to manage and control all of those interests is a real challenge. I think good chairs have to be quite deft politically, with a small p and with a big p. They have to be able, I think, to represent their sport publicly, and they have to be good ambassadors. That's as well as being able to manage a team, manage the chief executive, and make the decisions on, you know, how the executive team is performing. And there are plenty of people with good backgrounds who have that. If you look at the backgrounds of the people who are chairs of sports organizations, there's people like me who've worked within sport and within business before and can combine those two things. There are people who've only worked in business. There are people who've worked within business but have dealt with the sports organization. So to take, for example, someone like Gary Hoffman, Gary was a very successful businessman in the financial field. But as part of that, he had worked with the Premier League and was known by many of the clubs. He certainly possessed all of those characteristics that people would be looking for. So sports will tend now to have their chair as somebody independent. And they will tend to find that person by a recruitment process that will involve advertising and a wide search.
Well, as you say, and you know, sometimes this will all get lost in the wash now. But Gary Hoffman came with a wonderful CV. You know, Northern Rock, Barclays, of course, was a big sponsor of the Premier League. Coventry Building Society, big sponsor now of Coventry. He'd made bids for Coventry. He knew the game. He's a football fan. He had a great pedigree. But anyway, look, thanks, Simon. You've, I think, explained nicely what a chair is, how you find them, the skills they have. You also mentioned some wonderful FA language, stakeholders, Alex. How many times have you and I talked about stakeholders and managing stakeholders? So look, would it be right in thinking that you were sort of a CEO figure at the FA?
Yes, definitely.
Yes. I mean, I don't know if they were calling you that at the time, were they?
No, so they changed the language to General Secretary, and that is not uncommon in European parlance. And the FIFA and UEFA lead executives will typically be general secretaries. And if you remember the circumstances, it was around the time after David Treisman left somewhat abruptly, and we were in the middle of our 2018 World Cup bid.
I do remember.
Which, Simon knows better than I do. And one of the things the board decided was that there was a degree of pomposity to being, it was only the English national associations who had chief executives. Everyone else was general secretary. So they said general secretary, but the reality was the role was full-blown chief executive. I think just to pick up on a couple of things Simon said, from my perspective, it's quite a fluid relationship. But the important thing is to understand who's responsible for what and make sure there are no gaps. There cannot be any gaps between the chair and the chief exec for all the reasons that Simon said, because between them, they have to manage that entire agenda, all the stakeholders, the external people who are interested in the game, in the business, whether that's the league or indeed a club or the National Association. There are many people who are interested in the goings on. And then there's all the staff and the activities. And both chair and chief exec, and indeed other, you know, board members and senior exec can play a lead role in that. When Simon and I worked together at the FA with, at the time, Brian Barwick and Jeff Thompson, we had the situation where Jeff was very token chair with limited responsibility and capability. And he was chairing council meetings and he would chair the board, but he didn't have the capability to run a £300-400 million turnover business, manage the assets, build out Wembley Stadium, build out St. George's Park. So he would take support from the exec. And that's, you know, largely where Brian, Simon and I acted as an important triumvirate. And then we brought in important people to pick up specific areas of expertise like Trevor Brooking at the time. So the strength and balance is in getting the right exec in roles to do the job, the right support from the board with the independence, being able to balance the views of the stakeholders. But the linchpin, the critical junction is between the chairman and chief execs. That's what holds the whole thing together.
I thought you'd say that, and I'm glad you did, because it is, of course, called the FA Premier League. And whilst you worked for the FA, not the Premier League, what is your understanding of that relationship at the Premier League between chair and chief exec at the Premier League?
I'll be honest, Matt, my experience was 5 or 6 years ago when we were talking Richard Scudamore and Sir David Richards. And in that relationship, there was a very clear split of responsibilities where Richard was, you know, he was entitled executive chairman for a reason. Sir Dave's role was very much around the stakeholder management. And that meant some of the club relationships, but it meant FIFA, UEFA, the European leagues, and FA roles. He was actively busy in managing those elements of the stakeholders. And Richard took the primary responsibility for managing both the clubs and obviously the commercial business of the Premier League. Since then, it's moved around a bit. So I don't know whether, Simon, you have a better view of the relationship between Richard and Gary.
Well, I don't, but I think it's worth just, I think, talking a little bit about the Premier League itself and how it's structured, because it's slightly different to many organisations. It has a board, which is a small board, which is given powers under the rule book to take decisions of a regulatory nature. And lots of those decisions are taken out of the hands of the 20 member clubs who are the shareholders to avoid conflicts of interest. So the board is able to take a lot of regulatory decisions, and the board is clearly the domain, although there's a chair, that's really run by the chief executive or the senior executive. What you then have, however, is the actual group of the 20 shareholders. And quite a lot of the big commercial decisions are taken by those 20 shareholders. The decision-making structure is actually set up so that no decision can be passed without 14 clubs of those 20 passing it. Now, that either enables decision-making or it entrenches opposition, depending on what the issue is. Now, the fascinating thing about the 20 clubs is that the only thing that they have in common is that they happen to be playing in the Premier League in that particular season. Beyond that, they compete with each other on the pitch. They would say that they compete with each other in the transfer market for the best players. They compete with each other, perhaps for coaches. Perhaps if you've got more than one club in the same city, they might argue that they're competing with each other for commercial revenue, ticketing, etc.
Sponsors, shirt suppliers, absolutely. You name it.
Now, because of that, as a group, they are quite good at agreeing collective matters that benefit them all. So a television deal, and of course they do very well with raising their television revenues, a sponsorship deal that benefits them all. Where they are not so good and where the tensions come in is when there is perceived to be an issue that benefits or disadvantages either one club or one group of clubs. And then the conflicts break out, and that's where a strong chair can help. I mean, as it happens, I think Richard Scudamore was a strong chief executive, and he would do a lot of management of those. And if there was a difficult issue, he wouldn't put it to a vote. He would take it back and try and get it resolved. My sense, although I don't have personal knowledge, is that in this relationship, I think the chair will manage much more the club-related issues that come to them as shareholders, and that perhaps that's where some of the tension has arisen over the Newcastle United issue.
I got it. That does make sense, and it is—it's what I'm hearing. I just want to ask both of you, because you've both mentioned him, Richard Scudamore. So he was there for a very long time, and that makes succession difficult when someone has done a good job for a very long time. And a lot of this that we've been talking about with the Premier League does sort of appear to have happened in this kind of succession phase, really. I mean, you guys work with him. Why was he so effective? What made him good? Alex, you want to have a go?
I think what made him a really strong character was probably partly experience, but also sort of, I'd say, consistency. One of the key things that we haven't really delved into, we could be here for hours really, is not only have you got the conflicts we talk about within the league, but you've then got potential conflicts every day between, say, the Football League and the Premier League, the FA and the Premier League. And where in a very, very good working relationship, Andy Williamson, Richard Scudamore and I would sit down every 2 weeks and have a 45-minute to an hour-long meeting and tidy some stuff up. And there were one or two, tanks on the lawn situation in terms of, why are the FA doing this, or why are the Football League doing this, or why are the Premier League doing this? It's not your responsibility. But quite often it would be a fairly straightforward conversation. Something new comes up and it's like, it's overlapping in the rule books. Like, as long as you do it, keeps up to speed, that's fine. And so I found him incredibly professional, straightforward and consistent. As Simon alluded to, I think he was a really good diplomat. He was obviously a very strong commercial operator, but he was a really good diplomat when it came to getting things through the clubs. I sat in all of the Premier League shareholder meetings for about the last 7 years of my role as COO and then CEO. I could probably remember one or two votes that ever failed. Stuff just doesn't go to a vote if the work hasn't been done ahead of the meeting.
Richard had built up a lot of trust because he'd done outstanding commercial deals. And therefore the clubs would they gave him a lot of rope and allowed him to run with quite a high degree of autonomy. He was very, very good on their behalf about protecting the interests of the Premier League. He was very combative in that respect. And as a result, I think the clubs built up a high degree of trust. And he, I think, had their temperature. He knew where an issue would create a problem at club level, and he would try and resolve it before it became an issue. And on the few occasions when I was there where a matter got onto the floor of the meeting and there was clearly going to be a row and it wouldn't be resolved, in the majority of cases, not all of them, Richard would take it back and try and bring it again back to another meeting. I don't know how that works. And it's certainly true now that there is a different ownership structure of many of the clubs. Many of the clubs are owned by overseas institutions or overseas-based wealthy, high-net-worth individuals. Some of them come from other sporting environments and are used to other ways of working. And I think that brings a different type of pressure because they are not a homogenous group. And as time goes on, they are becoming less and less homogenous, and therefore the need for very skillful management of that group at all times becomes higher and higher.
I think that brings us really nicely, actually, Simon, to my last point, really, with you guys. And that is this sense that I've been picking up, that this job, these jobs, really, because we have mentioned the other Richard, and that's Richard Masters, who is the current chief exec, that their jobs have got really hard. I mean, some of it is just luck and events, right? So, you know, the pandemic, some of it, I guess, is sort of the Super League stuff that comes round every few years. And it's just, you know, come round again at this time whilst we're talking about the pandemic too. Newcastle, I think, would have been a challenge. It poses deep philosophical challenges. You know, who knows how Richard Scudamore would have dealt with that. But just there's a lot going on. And Simon, as you've said, the ownership group, the ownership groups in the clubs, different people, different expectations. Is this job just becoming impossible?
No, I don't think so. I mean, if you take any one of those issues, I guess, again, where you could improve, I suspect, is this transparency and clear accountability. I couldn't tell you who in that structure that Simon described between the clubs and the board and the executive, who made that decision vis-a-vis Newcastle. I could probably recall just about what the directors and owners' roles are, but they're not particularly public. And I suspect, whether you like it or not, the reality is that PIF met the rules, but there's nobody explaining that. There's nobody fronting it up. You can't tell who made that decision. There's no transparency around any investigatory work that went on, any, you know, background checking and so on and so on. Now, it doesn't have to be public, but there are any number of examples, and Simon alluded to this discrepancy earlier, or this distinct difference. You know, in limited company life, there's little scrutiny. In PLC life, there's more scrutiny. In sporting life, dare I say, Yorkshire County Cricket Club, there is incredible scrutiny, and a misstep quite quickly snowballs. It wouldn't have been difficult with hindsight, and easy to say with hindsight, to go back to, there are the rules and they've met them for the following reasons. And this individual, this group, this, they made a decision, a piece of work was commissioned from ABC experts, and that's the decision we've come to. But the way it was kind of then, you know, leaked out, and it was suddenly on this newspaper and this new social media, the clubs didn't know, the fans of Newcastle didn't know, you know, badly handled. And I don't think there's any excuse for that, really. I don't know. I'm not blaming anyone, but that isn't difficult to fix. And I think any one of these issues, that they've got the resources and the brain power and the horsepower to manage them. They just need clear accountability.
Do you agree, Simon?
I do agree. I mean, to answer your question, is the job impossible? Certainly not. It's hard, but, you know, people are well paid to do it. I think that there has to be clarity on roles and responsibilities. And going back to our initial comments about the responsibility between the executive and the chair, I suspect that in this case of Newcastle, the rules were pretty clear as to whether it would go through or not. And what probably wasn't clear was that the clubs were not given, do not appear to have been given that impression that it was clear or otherwise. That, I believe, as Alex said, comes down to communication and transparency. And the fact that you need to be able, where if you've got the temperature of an issue that is going to be controversial, that you are able to communicate it, not just within the group, but more broadly. And Alex has quite rightly raised the Yorkshire cricket issue. I was just talking about that this morning. That is an issue that involved one county, its football equivalent would be a club. And yet you saw yesterday that the governing body was also in Parliament. So you had the current, you had the chair, you had executives, you had the old chair, the new chair, you had the governing body. And actually there are certain issues where, because the impact may be broader than the individual body, or because there may be a gap in the rules, it does require all the bodies within the sport to work closely together. And you can therefore see that if you get a big issue that has a high degree of public interest, that's the case where actually the chair probably has to play a greater role than they would normally do, simply because, as both Alex and I have said, this is a sport and it's very heavily scrutinized, not just by the public, by the media, but actually on issues like this, it's scrutinized by politicians, by parliament and by government. And so none of that makes this as an impossible job. I mean, there are many people who get very excited by managing these challenges, but it does require a great deal of political dexterity and a great deal of awareness of public interest and how things might land when it leaves your table and goes out into the outside world.
Indeed. Well, look, that's a great place to leave it. Thanks very much for your time, chaps. Given us plenty to chew over there. I wish you well with your impossible jobs.
Oh, not possible. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Matt.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Next up, we'll hear what it's like to be inside meetings between the executives and chairs like Gary Hoffman at the Premier League and the chief execs of the Premier League clubs. Keith Wyness is a former chief executive of Premier League sides Aston Villa and Everton, and he's with us now. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Keith. We've been talking with Simon Johnson and Alex Horn about chief execs and chairs and how it kind of works and how you find these people. You sat in on these meetings, these shareholder meetings, you know, when you were at Everton and Aston Villa. What did you expect and want from a Premier League chair?
The main thing we wanted was for them to be a good sounding board that could take the temperature of across the whole league and do it in a very discreet, behind-the-scenes way. That was the most important thing. I think it was very difficult for a chief executive who has operational responsibility to be able to do that. So they were the ones that had to understand the difference between the black and the white and the colours of grey and the shades of grey that were there. Also, I would have wanted the chairman to be a sounding board to government, to other areas as well, and to try, you know, if there were other parties involved in particular issues, I wanted him to be able to be out there and protect the clubs to a degree from any direct involvement. He's a very important middleman in terms of issues as they crop up.
Gary Hoffman's gone. He has officially gone now. We're recording this on Wednesday. We have been aware that this was coming for a few weeks. And whilst it's not the only issue, the Newcastle United takeover saga, I think, was the last straw for him and some of the clubs. I know it's difficult for you to say now because you're not at one of the clubs right now, and this hasn't been your issue. But if you could put your Villa or Everton hat back on, what would you have been wanting to hear from Premier League HQ during this process? What would you have expected to hear?
I think I would have just wanted them to be governing things appropriately and to protect the Premier League from particular lawsuits. That's what I'd have been worried about. You know, I think there are still a lot of issues around this in terms of operating as cartels and all sorts of things that seem to be looking at from the outside. I'd have wanted them to protect the league and to adhere to the policies and the laws and to precedents that have been set in the past from other new owners coming in.
Would you have expected much input in the sort of final yay-nay decision?
No, the Premier League isn't like the NFL when the owners all get together and decide who they're going to invite into the club. Now, if it wants to go that way, it's a different thing. But at the moment, it isn't like that. And there is there, you know, the potential here, which I've had in my time, is the conflict between the top group of clubs and the rest. And it seems, once again, we've got that situation. And it is the chairman's responsibility to try and handle that conflict between the little power group at the top and the rest. And so much of this comes down to the chairman's personality. And it really is crucial. I mean, you know, Scudamore had a larger-than-life personality and was able to face up to the pressures that were put upon him. I can't say, obviously, because I haven't dealt in terms of the recent things, but it's a big pressure from those clubs that they exert, and somebody's got to really be able to stand up to them.
Let's find a real-life example, then, from your time. You know, a big contentious issue that got us all talking, got people like me moaning and asking annoying questions. 39th game, right? That was probably one of the big issues that Scudamore faced. And I think you were very involved.
It was. It was a big one. It was like the Super League of its time. And I had supported Scudamore in the 39th game. And then he turned, did a U-turn and dropped us in it and decided to go away from it. But look, I still could see there that why he did it. It was important, though, that if somebody's going to float ideas and to go forward, that they do take a consensus of the league behind them. And that's what a chairman should be doing, as I said at the start, taking a temperature and knowing that there's support within the league and making sure if big decisions are going to be taken, that they're going to be able to have a plan to actually announce them properly.
Just looking from the outside in, as you are now, is it entirely clear to you what Gary Hoffman was doing, what his responsibilities were, what he was good at, and what Richard Masters, the chief exec, was doing and what he was good at? Do you have a firm handle on that?
No, I don't. Looking at it from the outside, I don't. I mean, again, I mentioned personality being absolutely crucial. And I've been in situations where there's been a very strong chief executive, or I've had to be a strong chief executive with a weak or retiring chairman. And other times when there's been a strong chairman and you've got to be much quieter as a chief executive. I didn't see the two of them being, either of them, being particularly strong in terms of the public persona and the way that they presented cases to the public. In Richard's case, obviously, he's gaining with experience, and I think he's doing a great job. But normally, one of the other ones has to play good cop, bad cop, or whatever, and I didn't see that double act forming together very well.
In defence, right, they've had quite a lot on their plate, the pandemic, Super League, big picture. There's been, you know, and then, of course, Newcastle. There's been a fair amount to deal with. Would you, though, have expected them almost to sort of kind of do that dovetail, that good cop, bad cop thing?
Yeah, I think I would have. And you're quite right. Look, it's been, but then again, the Premier League's never quiet. I mean, you know, there's always something happening. We all know that. And I think they've done a great job. And I'm surprised that Gary's gone. I think it was actually starting to form that partnership that I was talking about. And that could have come in time, because it does take time to get through some big upsets to actually forge that partnership together. And maybe that was coming now after COVID, as you say, after Super League and Newcastle. I mean, perhaps that was the making of a whole great new partnership in an era. And I didn't really think it was a need for him to resign, but this is all about potentially the politics of those 20 shareholders.
So, Keith, one of the things that often comes up from fans whenever I talk about this stuff or write about this stuff, they do sort of say, well, how do these meetings actually work? Do the clubs argue it out? Is there a big debate? Does someone stand up and make a speech that carries the room? Or is it all done on phones afterwards? What actually happens?
Well, it used to be that there'd be a lot of people would come into London the night before. So there'd often be dinners with little groups, threes or fours would get together the night before. Again, as I say, the chairman would try and take the temperature. So they would try and avoid any major conflicts but often there were contentious issues that were going to come down to a close vote. And it would be the case of having to make speeches on the day on the floor. And certainly, as I say, in my time, there were quite a few heated meetings, but we were able to get there. It's always easy to do that when the financial numbers are going up and up, as they did with the TV revenue in our time. So people can always look at that greater good. We haven't really reached that period yet, and the Premier League's going into a decline. And that's when I think it's going to get very, very nasty.
You say that, but I think they've got some good news on the horizon very soon, I think. I think they are about to announce an absolutely blockbuster US TV deal, sure. Which I think will be good.
Absolutely.
Will be good for Richard Masters. I think it will bolster the collective again. And it also makes me think that you're onto something when you say that maybe Hoffman and Masters could have weathered this.
I really do. As I say, I mean, in business in general, you've got to have a breakdown to have a breakthrough. And I think this was starting to be a great little partnership for what I could see. But it was going to take time. It always does. And having gone through the tortuous process of finding Richard to get that job and Gary for that position as well, after what's 18 months for it to go, I think is very sad. You're right. The US deal will be a great one to announce. And I think that gives the momentum to go forward. And after the Super League, there was some strength back in the Premier League administration as well. So I didn't see this coming, to be honest. I was a bit surprised it's come about.
You mentioned the search, and the last one was tortuous. It was tortuous for Richard Masters, and it wasn't much better for finding a new chair. I mean, the interim, was it Claudio Arni, did it for best part of 2 years. So it's going to be tough. Now, what tends to happen in these situations? Does a committee get formed? Is there a committee kind of semi-formed already?
Well, yeah, I think Bruce Buck led the last committee, and I'll be surprised if he wants to do it again. I don't know, because he didn't really have a lot of luck last time. So maybe that has to be a more balanced committee, I think, in terms of how that's selected. I think every headhunter in the world's gone out looking for people. So, it's going to be a difficult one to see how they're going to find somebody that's going to take it on. But we'll find somebody, I'm sure.
I think in our last segment, Simon Johnson, who's obviously done FA, bit of Premier League, and is at the RFL now. I think his last answer might have been an application for the job. So Keith, I'm not going to ask you to do the same unless you want to. But what are we looking for? Paint the ideal candidate.
Well, I think it needs a much higher public profile than Gary gave it. I think you've got to be that front person. And I think you've got to take the pressure off the executive and Richard to a degree and be that face of the Premier League and be able to front those things out. And also to be able to stand up in a room with the bigger clubs. And that's got to be somebody, I think, first of all. The personality is the crucial thing there. And the public presence, the media savvy, and the experience to do it. I think you've got to be financially really savvy in this position. And that's where it's going to be the key. But it's all about personality and presence.
I said to the other guys, is it an impossible job? I'm going to twist it slightly for you because you've painted a sort of a picture of someone. Are we looking for a unicorn? Does that person exist?
No, it's not a unicorn. A person does exist. And I think maybe perhaps they've been overthinking it before. That person does exist. There are some perfectly good business leaders out there that could do this, provided they understand that they're walking into a situation that changes every day. But you've got to be involved in football in some way to really understand the whole weird way that football just goes in a split second. And so unless they're coming in from a business that's got a similar sort of trajectory, I think they've got to have some sort of football experience in their background at some stage in some way, because otherwise you just don't understand it until you've been burnt the baptism of fire a few times.
Well, there you go. Baptism. We're doing the life cycle in reverse here. That's a great way to end it, I think. Thanks very much for your time, Keith. Obviously, if you do fancy the job, we'll package up your answers and send them to the Premier League HQ.
Well, congratulations on breaking the story yesterday, and maybe my announcement is the next one. You can break that one as well.
There we go. That's what we like. Well, thanks so much, Keith. Bye-bye.
Cheers, Matt. All the best. Bye.
Right, that's it, and thanks to all our guests. Don't forget, if you're not a subscriber to The Athletic, then head to theathletic.com/footballpod for a 33% discount off the price of an annual subscription. And thanks for listening.
The Athletic.